CAP Radio in Sacramento. This is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Tomorrow marks 2 weeks since the primary, and we are still waiting for some important local and statewide races to be finalized. Locally, hanging in the balance, the Sacramento mayoral race is still up in the air. We still don't know which top two candidates will officially face off in November. In Sacramento County, the next batch of election results are due tomorrow afternoon, Tuesday, and there are less than 30,000 ballots to be processed, so there's still some wiggle room. And then, of course, there's Prop 1, the statewide mental health and housing bond Governor Newsom had been pushing pretty hard, the yes side leading by a razor-thin margin. Prop 1 opponents have conceded, but it still remains too close to call. Joining us today to get an update on the vote count, the vote trends, turnout, and more are Paul Mitchell, Vice President of Political Data Incorporated, and political strategist Mike Madrid. Thank you both. Good afternoon.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So let's start local with the mayoral race in the city of Sacramento, Paul. It has been a really suspenseful, interesting race. Each ballot drop on Tuesday or Friday, things can really change drastically. Currently, we have epidemiologist Dr. Flojan Kofer leading at 28%. But then the other three, Assemblymember Kevin McCarty, former state senator Richard Pan, former city council member Steve Hansen, they're all in a tie. I mean, they're only separated by a couple hundred votes. What stands out to you about this race?
Well, you're exactly right. What's interesting is when we first talked right after the election, Flo Kofer was actually in fourth. And I actually had a reporter call me and say, well, can we just assume this is a three-person race now that she's out of it? My response was no, that a lot of these late ballots that are coming in were a lot younger. They potentially were a pool of voters that was a lot better for Flo Kofer, and that held true. She now has kind of an enormous lead for the for how tight this race has been. I think she has essentially punched her ticket to go into the general election with these other three candidates really jostling in these late ballots. And they seem to kind of pull from each other a lot. Richard Pan has been in the lead up until recently, and that's probably buoyed by a lot of the early votes from Asian voters who traditionally have done better in vote by mail in those early ballots, and maybe that has been slipping a tiny bit. But there's still, you know, 7,500 or more ballots to tabulate, we expect. That's our estimate. And when you look precinct by precinct, there's actually more precincts or more votes in the precincts that Pan won that are still outstanding. That doesn't mean he's going to win those votes, but it just means that that might be something that he can cling to. And then, of course, McCarty is ahead by, I think, 160 votes. And you'd always want to be ahead than behind.
Yeah. I mean, it's so interesting looking hyper-local because statewide, according to your data, I mean, voter turnout has been like 30%. I mean, that's going to change as we continue to get more ballots processed. But what does voter turnout look like for the city of Sacramento? I mean, this is a big race for people in the city.
Yeah. So the city of Sacramento is at 39% turnout. And then when you look even more locally, Council District 4 is over 50% turnout. And that is one of the historically lower turnout areas in the city with that downtown area. Previously, it was downtown and Land Park. And so Land Park was a base of voters. Now it's downtown in East Sac. And we see higher turnout in that council district. And also in that race, Katie Valenzuela versus Phil Pluckebaum, a real polarizing race with literally Alhambra Boulevard dividing. She won every precinct north of Alhambra Boulevard and he won every precinct south. So it's an interesting race.
Yeah. And Katie Valenzuela is the current city council member. And as it stands now, Phil Pluckebaum is in the lead at 52% versus 43%. Ballots, of course, still being processed. What impact do you think redistricting had on this city council district? Because now it includes East Sacramento.
Yeah, I mean, the redraw was essentially everything for this district because, you know, in decades past, they used to take the downtown area and split it up so that everybody had a piece of downtown in their district, but essentially nobody cared a lot about downtown. It was just only a part of a small part of their district. Now there's a downtown core. And the question was in redistricting, in the last two redistrictings, where does this downtown pair up? Does it downtown pair up with Natomas or with Land Park or with East Sac? And it switched. from a Land Park downtown to a ESAC downtown. And then Cato Valenzuela, who's the incumbent council member, did become somewhat of a polarizing figure, particularly to those East Sacramento voters, many of whom attempted unsuccessfully to recall her, even though they hadn't voted for her. And this election seems to kind of be showing again that divide, essentially with Alhambra Boulevard being the, I guess it's east-west, not north-south split of the of that district.
Mm. Well, Mike, I mean, you're an expert in political strategy, outreach, demographics. I mean, before we go statewide, what stands out to you about these local city races?
You know, Sacramento as a city has always kind of fascinated me. It's obviously, you know, I guess my hometown. I've lived here for 20 years, but in many ways, it's so different from other cities and states that are working across the country. I think there's a danger in almost reading too much about the ideology of what was driving voters. This is still very much a small town. A lot of people who were actually voting in this election knew one or more of these candidates, certainly for mayor. And I think in the Valenzuela, you know, Plucky Bomb seat, this was a really, I live in that district. I live in Midtown. I'm one of those people who voted for Plucky Bomb in probably the most Valenzuela district because, you know, the issue of homelessness just really, you know, burst through everything that I was thinking about and reminds me, as somebody who looks at these mega trends, that, you know, these local issues do make a very big difference and define these candidates. It clearly did in that race. That was just a huge divining rod. In the other race, this, you know, I think it's healthy for Sacramento to have that competitive a race where there are that many candidates running that close. And we'll just, you know, we'll have to see. I mean, I think it's probably pretty clear with these, where who's going to make the top two, but you know, there are still votes to be counted.
Yeah. I mean, when it comes to Prop 1, that was the only proposition on the ballot statewide. Governor Newsom lobbied heavily for it. I mean, part of it included voters approving a $6.4 billion bond in addition to like restructuring how the state spends money on mental health and which relates to homelessness as well. It is leading by a razor thin margin. I mean, Mike, given that it's barely squeaking by, there was a lot of lobbying and campaigning on Governor Newsom's behalf. If this does get approved by voters, even a narrow margin, is this still a victory or does this actually impact his political clout?
Well, a victory is a victory. I mean, if you win by one vote, ultimately no one's going to remember it probably in a couple of weeks. And you know, people like Paul and I will look at this as a data point for forever and it will tell us something. But the average person isn't going to be like, well, it only passed by a handful of votes. So, yeah, look, it's causing some heartburn and some angst. But for the most part, I think it's in pretty safe ground. And again, I think there are some bigger dynamics that probably needed to and should be considered. It's easy to armchair quarterback now. You know, was going in March a good idea? Did the ballot label, you know, give them everything they wanted since they were able to, you know, craft this thing? Yeah, what does it say about the governor's support levels or opposition with, you know, I'm just one of those people that never believes putting a politician out front of any measure for anything, especially when you're asking for money, is a good idea. That's not necessarily a referendum on Gavin Newsom. It's just a referendum on politicians. It's just not a wise strategy. But again, like I said, it's easy to armchair quarterback. I really think a lot of this is going to be overblown. If this does pass, which I suspect it probably will, I don't think people are going to remember it in 10 days, 2 weeks.
Yeah, I mean, Paul, given that the margin right now between yes and no on Prop 1 is like 20,000 votes, I mean, opponents of Prop 1, they officially conceded last week. But is that still too narrow, given that ballots are still being processed?
Well, we're actually looking at where those ballots that are still being processed are from. And so counties like Alameda, Santa Clara are big sets of data still to come. It's those more conservative rural counties where it really lost big numbers. And so I think when we look at the outstanding ballots, that is favorable to the ballot measure. And so I think it will, like Madrid, I agree that it will pass. And then if I was, you know, spinning this for the Newsom side, I would just say, look, this was the electorate that would be the least amenable to a, you know, spending measure, to this kind of a ballot measure in a decade. It was a more conservative electorate in this primary than it would have been if there had been competitive presidential races. And even in this very kind of unfavorable electorate, it was able to pass. And it helps avoid putting this on a general election ballot where maybe it would get crowded with other fiscal issues. And you could have that situation where voters start voting against spending because of all the spending measures. So victory is a victory, like Mike said, and I think they're in a good position in terms of the outstanding ballots.
On the topic of spending locally, Measure C in Sacramento isn't looking good, and this would have gradually increased Sacramento's city business operations tax. The city says this hasn't been done since 1991, but 62% are against it so far. Do you think that there's a larger message about where voters stand right now when it comes to how state and local governments collect and spend money, Mike?
Yeah, look, there's no question there is. And any time that the perception of the economy is shaky or not doing well or heading into bad times, voters are going to be less amenable to opening up their pocketbook to anything, you know, especially government and government services. I also think this measure was particularly poorly rolled out. It kind of just came out and surprised everybody. And you know, my firm focuses on this with local governments. We've been experts in this for 25, 30 years. I've never seen anything kind of sprung on the voters like this and just like, oh, no, this is just a modernization or an update. Just very, very poorly rolled out. But there's also no question the appetite for bonding and taxing is just not going to be there. You know, all of the economic indicators are heading in one direction. Public sentiment is moving in the opposite direction. That's going to need to be reconciled by the politicians and by their teams to start saying, how are we going to start spending or asking the taxpayers slash voters to give us the benefit of the doubt to start moving forward with some of these measures. But this is kind of, you know, exhibit A on things on how not to proceed with a tax measure.
Mm. Another close race is Assembly District 6, or it's an interesting dynamic. I wouldn't necessarily call it close because Assembly District 6, which is in our area, I mean, there were 10 candidates in this race, seven of whom were Democrats, two were Republican, one was Peace and Freedom. And I'm curious how this race, given that California is a top two, regardless of party, like, did the Democrats candidates in this race, did they dilute the power of the Democratic vote? Because it looks like we're going to have a Democrat and a Republican in the top two ticket for November, Paul.
Yeah, so this was an interesting race, and going into it, there were two candidates on the ballot, and my perception was that it was almost a guarantee that one of the candidates, I presumed it would be Nikki Ellis, would be the one that would make it into the top two, because the Democrats had kind of a nasty campaign with a lot of negative mail going back and forth. So Maggie Krell definitely stood out, and the data suggested that she would be able to win, and then my guess was, you know, Nikki Ellis being second. On election night, I was talking to some consultants. I had one consultant tell me that she couldn't win because she didn't have a website. When we were doing the election night coverage on one of the local TV affiliates, they came up with the results showing Maggie Krell and then Nikki Ellis, and they literally just had the little silhouette of a head, you know, female shape there because they didn't have a picture of her. So this was a surprise to many, but when you look around the state, there are a lot of Republicans who got into the second spot, even if those Republicans were less well known, because you had this elevated Republican turnout, combination of a, you know, more interesting Republican primary on the Republican side, even though it was essentially over. And then potentially the more than $10 million spent in promoting Garvey's candidacy in the U.S. Senate race. We actually did some polling after the election and found that, you know, in some pockets of the electorate, conservative independents and more moderate Republicans, they cited the U.S. Senate race as the number one reason why they turned out to vote. So that elevated Republican participation really allowed a lot of Republicans to make it into runoffs, even if they were relatively unknown.
In the last minute that we have, Mike, I mean, now sights are on November. Voter turnout as it stands today is like 30%. I mean, it's not great. What do you think it'll take to drive people to the polls in November?
I think we're going to have pretty high, a very robust turnout in November because voters are much more motivated now by what we call negative partisanship, which means we all know what partisanship means and hyperpartisanship. But negative partisanship is kind of when it all metastasizes and people vote against things more than they vote for things. So even though there is not, and again, this low turnout is something we're seeing all over the country. This is not unique to California. When people are motivated and the existential threat that both parties see and feel about the other party becomes real, voters will be motivated. Now, they will be voting more against somebody than for somebody. But we have been in a period of pretty high sustained turnout. 2018, we had the highest, you know, midterm turnouts in like 100 years. 2020 was a record high turnout. 2022. It was seconds to 2018. So voters are scared. They're afraid that if their team doesn't win, that the, you know, the republic's going to end, and they're voting accordingly. So, you know, look, we've seen this low turnout. You can ascribe it to non-competitive primaries. There's some truth to that. You can ascribe it to historically high negatives from both candidates. There's some truth to that. But the reality is, when it's a face-to-face between Joe Biden and Donald Trump, people are going to show up. Mm.
Mike Madrid is a political strategist, and Paul Mitchell is the vice president of Political Data, Inc. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.